Yeah? Is that okay?
Yes.
Perfect.
This is Graham Blair. I'm here at the Federal Palace Hotel with the Honorable Commissioner of Justice and Attorney General of Lagos State. We confirmed for the tape that you consented to the interview.
I consented to the interview.
Okay. Perhaps you could begin by talking about what, when you came into the position the first time, what your major priorities was, what your strategic vision for the reform of in the judicial sector.
Well, as you might know, several members of this administration had served in different roles in the administration before us. They had a very strong agenda for the justice sector. One of the things we quickly agreed to do was to strengthen the administration of justice, particularly in the area of the delivery of the service of justice, law and order, and essentially an orderly society. From the point of view of the justice sector reform, we found that there were certain areas of justice delivery service that had challenges and were somewhat inadequate. So our main focus was to address those areas.
What were some of those areas?
Well, I mean, what immediately stood out was the lowest tier of the courts, the magistrate courts, which, from every empirical study, was clear, took in the largest workload but had received the least attention over the last couple of decades. We had found that there was an infrastructure decay, there was a human capital deficiency, and there was outdated laws and procedures were being used, which made, in total, the entire, we call it the magistracy, so the magistrate courts, the first level of courts in Nigeria. We found that that made the entire magistrate court system rather ineffective. And this was a departure from what had happened in the past, and it was also the first time that magistrate courts would receive any sort of attention anywhere in Nigeria. We are convinced that if we are able to address the renewal in the magistrate courts, that the justice system as a whole will be more effective, because this was a tier, as I said earlier on, that treated at least somewhere between 60 and 70% of the entire caseload, both from a public law point of view, criminal law, even some of the most common civil disputes. And if we could fix that level of court, we would reinforce the confidence that the public much needed in the court system. And we will also bring the court system as a more effective tool in establishing or strengthening law and order, and therefore an orderly society. So this was our thinking.
What were some of the challenges as you came in that had prevented the reform of the magistrate system before you came into office?
Well, I think, honestly speaking, I think that I think there was a perception problem. There was almost a collective belief that if you just went to the high courts, the superior courts, and you did reforms in the high courts, that the justice delivery in Lagos State and Nigeria would be better. And we think this was a bit of an error, or an oversight. Let me say an oversight, in the sense that because the hierarchy of courts are so interconnected, that if you fix the second level of courts without going to the basic first level of courts, you would really never affect the justice system at all. Because matters that ought to have been dealt with at the first tier of court system, people would just skip that level and go to the high courts. And what the anecdotal evidence that showed... Let me stop. Should I continue? Can we tell them to?
Yeah.
Let me go and tell them. Let me go and tell them. Let me go and tell them.
This is part two of why did the coalition of supporters that you were part of come to this point where it seemed like this was the reform that would be successful in changing?
I think one of the reasons that led us to this belief was rooted in the fact that as an output, as an indice of development, we felt that we needed to have, in order to have economic growth, you needed to have law and order on the public law side and security of contract and enforcement of contract on the private law side. And these are the products of a good justice system. And it was quite clear that there was a challenge here. The investing public needed to have a reinforced belief that the justice system would protect the obligations that they distilled into a contract and that you could enforce them in an impartial, transparent, and effective way. On the other hand, the public also needed to feel more secure, believing that the criminal justice system would respond to the needs of society in an effective way that would deter crime and create more order in their society so that they could enjoy their liberties. These were the two things that we thought a good justice system would produce: the sanctity of contract and an orderly society, law and order. So it was clear that we do have to address the justice system. And the deficiency was in the magistrate court, which I have quite clearly said that this is where the bulwark of disputes as well as legal administration was carried out. And we therefore quickly embarked on a not fact-finding, but a blueprint making exercise by inaugurating and establishing a magistracy and justice sector reform committee. I think it was made up of 12 people who sat for a little over a year and made some recommendations. These recommendations were taken to cabinet. One of the main things was that the executive council, which is the cabinet of government, accepted literally all of the recommendations and established a technical and implementation committee that was now to implement the recommendations of the Justice Sector Reform Committee, which I chair that committee, and we've been carrying out the implementation now since 2008, a little over a year, about a year.
The magistrate courts are part of the judicial branch of
yes.
the state government.
Yes.
What was that committee made up of? The reform committee made up of some people from the executive.
People from the judiciary. Yes, that's right. We had magistrates themselves to give first-hand information about their experiences. We had people from the police as well there, and we had private practitioners who were obviously the users of our justice system, and they could immediately tell the effect that it was having on them and what they probably wanted to see. So it was a multi-sectoral committee.
And what about the implementation committee now? How are you going about interacting with the judicial branch and beginning to make some of these reforms?
Well, again, we have three magistrates on that committee. I sit as a statutory member of the Judicial Service Commission by virtue of my office. I'm a member of the Judicial Service Commission, which is chaired by the Chief Judge of Lagos State. Judicial Service Commission is the organ that organizes all the affairs of the judicial officers and judicial staff and really carries out the maintenance and promotes the good organization of the judiciary as a whole. So that's a very useful place where the executive and the judiciary interface, because I'm the only member of the executive on that committee. But what the Technical and Implementation Reform Committee has done is to draft new laws. We've drafted a brand new magistrate courts law. We've drafted a brand new customary courts law, a new Judicial Service Commission set of rules, a new tenancy law, and several other civil procedure rules to make sure that the courts work faster. We restrict the number of adjournments that the courts can take on and shorten by legislation the length of time that it takes for a case to start and end. And we've also institutionalized Saturday as a day for the business of the court, which we believe will allow them to do more within the week and also to do more urgent work without just shutting down the courts on Friday and not letting them work on the Saturday. And we also think it will help with the protection of civil liberties, because the Constitution requires that a person who is accused of a criminal offense should be brought before a court of law within 24 hours. Often what happens is that if anybody's arrested on Friday, because there is no court system till Monday, inevitably that constitutional provision is frequently breached by the state themselves. So by extending the sittings of the court into Saturday, it reduces the this infraction of civil liberties by making sure there is a court open over the weekend to have people arraigned, to have people charged, to have people be granted bail where it's necessary.
One of the other parts of the reform that you described earlier was the rebuilding the human capital in the magistrate court system. What were some of the challenges in the lack of human capital there? What were the deficiencies?
Well, I mean, the magistrate courts law and the legislation governing the affairs of that level of court, the legislation is about 40 years old, and with amendments here and there. So we found that some of the personnel were not probably optimally used. By this I mean categorically the presiding officer, who is called a magistrate, but for all intents and purposes is actually a district judge in many other jurisdictions. She takes in longhand a transcript of the proceedings in a book. You can imagine somebody who has on his or her docket an average of 50 cases in any given day, having to take the proceedings in longhand. It contributes to the delay in the proceedings. It contributes in no small measure to a reduced ability to effectively adjudicate. If she is a minute taker, as well as a verbatim recorder, it's very difficult for her to consider to use her faculties for judicial work. So we found that was quite inappropriate, quite incongruous. So we needed to take that duty, we needed to take away that responsibility from the presiding officer and separate adjudication from record keeping. That was fundamental, and we found that it had affected morale. It had affected the output of the presiding officer, and the whole perception of the service being delivered, justice, was greatly diminished by just that. And what we then did was we took a comparative study of what was going on elsewhere in the world as far as verbatim court recording was concerned. And we settled for a stenographic technology intervention, if you like. And we institutionalized that into the rules of the court, that there will be a verbatim court recorder who is not the presiding officer, who will be responsible for the record of the proceedings. And we then embarked on a training of a crop of people to perform that role, because a stenographic machine is is a skilled operation. It's not something anybody can do. So we immediately sounded out the public, did a selection of 66 candidates based on English proficiency and dexterity with a keyboard for the first training of stenographic verbatim court recorders in Nigeria. We're collaborating with an organization called the Legal Support Training Center, which is also funded by the state government. And these people are in an advanced stage of their training. We think that they will be ready to be used, deployed in the system in another 3 to 4 months. So, I mean, you may not be able to appreciate it, but that single act, I think, will revolutionize justice delivery in Lagos State and in Nigeria, because it's the first time it's been done. It will have this effect. It will have the effect of freeing the court to be able to make instant decisions affecting both life, liberty, and property in no small measure. So we can't wait. We're excited at the prospect of using these people in the court system. The average training, if I'm not mistaken, internationally accepted, is about 138 words per minute. And these chaps are doing very well. They're in their hundreds. So we reckon another 4 months of their training. Verbatim court recording will be done in a technology-based method in Lagos State. Well, I mean, anything in the legal profession is an ongoing education process. And we think that there is and will always be a need to have in-service continuous education, continuous training program for judicial officers, just in the same way as many lawyers choose to continue to do coursework and seminars and conferences. So we are training the magistrates in a deliberate schedule of training now, not just on an ad hoc basis. Also, we think that the prosecutor is a very key person in the criminal justice system. What the new legislation does is that it stops police prosecution by non-lawyers. Typically, what has happened, it's an overflow of our colonial past. Police men are entitled to prosecute cases. And we found that the quality of prosecution coming from policemen who are not lawyers has left much to be desired. It's opened up the entire inefficiency that the police bring along in what really is not their core competence. Their core competence is policing. So they're being sidetracked into this other work, which, and they're not very good at it. So the legislation stops it. And we think that that will balance out the equation in any typical criminal trial. You will have skilled, trained lawyers prosecuting, and you have skilled, trained lawyers defending. So the state begins to get as much legal expertise as the defense can procure. And then the judge is able to deal with both people on an even keel. And we believe it also speed up the effect it has on a suspect offender, you know, with all the inefficiencies that we all accept that the police has. So that's an aspect of training, because it meant that the human capital deficiency in the prosecution in the magistrate court we had addressed through legislation.
Is there any opposition to that work?
Well, it's insidious. We'll always receive opposition. We're still getting all sorts of remarks, and people are not happy with it. But I think it's something whose time has come, and we're just going to carry on because it's in the best interest of the entire society.
So it's possible to convince the legislature.
Yeah, it's been passed into law now, yeah. And the governor has assented to it. So it's too late.
Fair enough. It seems like one of the important things here is figuring out how to build popular support for the judiciary again. What has been the procedure for beginning to engage with the public again? What's going on?
Well, we had to dig deep to do the reforms. And therefore, we felt that, look, if we can get a representative selection of the users on the committee, we could get a representation of what the public was experiencing and what they expected. But it doesn't take away the fact that we believe that we need to engage the public. So we're going to deliberately promote the law and the reforms that the law brings into place. But also, we have now started data sampling of people's experiences in the past so that we can be able to know which lever and which gear we need to really press into. So the data sampling is going to start, I think, in about a week or a fortnight, and essentially is to address perception, feel, experiences, to get anecdotal evidence of the areas in which the justice delivery system is being optimally deployed, is still facing challenges, where the improvements can come from. So we're doing a lot of data sampling, and we think that engagement with the public is also very important, because people need to know that we are fixing things, and that will only help to bolster their confidence.
Right. Are there public kind of appeals in the media or means of communication?
Yeah, we have an ongoing agenda. It's called the Law and Order Agenda. Occasionally, we put into the public space the need for people to, you know, work towards an orderly society. So we're doing that, but one has to also be very careful when you try and over-communicate. I say that advisedly, because as somebody who's involved in administration of justice, you need to one of the things you sell is confidence. The public must be confident that there is a system that works. To over-dissect it in the public space has its drawbacks. And, you know, I don't want to go into that anything.
Many of the ministry-based officials that we talk to say that one of the big challenges is changing the attitudes of civil servants and people working in the middle level. Are there examples from this first couple of years of this reform of strategies for changing the attitudes of people perhaps in the magistrates system?
Yeah, I mean...
Or has that been a problem?
The effectiveness of people will vary. And I don't think there is a broad brush that you can use to address how effective or not the civil service or the public service has been. I'm not sure there's one explanation that fits all. So I don't think there's much merit in generalizing either.
Fair enough. Are there particular strategies you used in this particular reform of the magistrates to think about changing attitudes about working hard or working toward having a more accountable
Yeah. Again, I think it's system-based. What we did in both the judicial service rules as well as the magistrate court's law is to address assessment and to monitor and evaluate performance and to set standards. We found that the previous legislative environment was easily exploited, because there were no institutional demands on performance. It was expected of people what was decent and what was proper. Everybody notionally felt, but it was very difficult for any public servant to measure himself against. So What the law does is that we appoint assessors, they're called performance assessors under the law. There's a periodic evaluation of performance. So the output of judicial officers will be a matter of record. It will not be enough for you to say, well, you know, I think I'm doing my best. Somebody will be testing the performance of judicial officers. So I think it's very good to do it in an objective way. And I think that's a way of addressing people's attitudes and changing it through a rules-based method, not a subjective or sometimes arbitrary method.
What are some of those performance measures? Those are things like how long it takes for a case to go through?
Absolutely. Those things are your caseload output. The specific guidelines will still be addressed in more detail, but it is your caseload output, it is your the quality of your decisions.
How do you measure that?
Well, I mean, we measure that not in the positive, in the negative. You don't measure that this was a good decision because you can never really tell what is good and what is good. But what you can tell is what is bad. So the judicial service rules clearly make decisions made without jurisdiction as a bad decision. Not an error as to jurisdiction, but decisions made where there was no judicial power to make those decisions. So we set a parameter as to what a bad decision is, not what a good decision is. So, and the presumption, it will raise a presumption. A perverse decision will raise a presumption of misconduct. And the Judicial Service Commission will set up an investigative committee and check the circumstances under which the decision was made. So we are not going to check quality as to whose decision is better than the other, no. But we will set a benchmark as to what a bad decision is. And there's clearly one that is made without power.
So there's the caseload output and the quality of the decisions. Are there other parts of performance that are being evaluated?
I think the others are rooted in the profession, with things like dignity, integrity, misconduct, efficiency. There's a very detailed set of rules that address all those issues: the dignity of the office, the integrity of the office, what is misconduct.
You mentioned sort of punitive consequences for bad decisions. Are there other? How else are these assessments tied to?
No, I think the general basis of the Judicial Service Commission rules is that that performance will be a reward based regime. I think that's the phrase that's used in the rules. But only to the extent of advancement. I don't think career advancement. I don't think we anticipate or contemplate a system of people getting money for good decisions, for goodness sake, never. But I think human personnel, human resource principle that we accept is that good performance will be rewarded by career advancement, just like in any multi-sector organization, which, as simple as it sounds, it's not a principle that had been clearly put on the table before.
Was performance being evaluated before at all? What were some of the unforeseen obstacles in this reform of the industries? What were some of the
unforeseen. I think it was just coming to terms with the deficiency gap. I think one of the biggest, it wasn't a shock or anything, but it was profound to me the closer we looked. the deficiency became more profound. And I think for us it was a big, that could have been a challenge, but I think we've overcome it. We haven't on the whole received consultative resistance from any sector. I think what we've done is now accepted, because there was a great consensus that it was an area that needed to be addressed. So I think there's a general acceptance, in fact, relief, that the intervention has come with this administration in this area. I can't really say unforeseen circumstances. Not really.
Why do you think it's been possible to begin this reform here in Lagos now, and it has not been possible?
Well, I think the governor, he himself is a senior lawyer who had a distinguished career as a bar advocate, as a barrister. But I think most importantly, in the public service that he's displayed in this administration, has brought a lot of belief from the public. The public have a lot of belief, they have a lot of trust, and there's a lot of expectation. So I think this has, in no small way, in fact, greatly contributed to the reforms, being accepted by both the profession and the public. The belief that this is a government that would do what it says, and they'd do it in the interest of the public. So I think the governor's leadership has played a large role in that.
What were the things done in the beginning to cultivate that expectation or trust that he would be able to get things done in the beginning?
I think it's just an example. I think it's just patently clear that the energy that the administration has brought to solving problems, and then the clear demonstration that there's a strong desire and a passion to achieve change. I think that's what was deliberate. And people have just seen that and believed it.
When you came into this position, one of the things people struggle with is building up their own staff to begin to work very hard on getting these reforms done. What were some of the challenges to building your own staff and finding the right talents to come into your office to get what you wanted to do?
Well, I mean, like most public appointments, you are entitled to select your own personal staff. And I was fortunate in selecting some people who, private sector legal practitioners, who've brought their own experience and their own thinking, their own knowledge and their own expertise into making sure the Office of the Attorney General produces the kind of product that can assist the reform agenda of the state government. So I think that has been a very important role. But then having said that, is also being very deliberate in finding that a lot of state counsel in the ministry who are very adaptable to change, very innovative, very solution-oriented people. So, yeah, it was just a question of handpicking them to lead. And I say to lead because, again, the public service as a whole will follow a good lead. And I learned that very quickly. I didn't believe that before I entered public service, but there is a lot of talent in the public service, but, you know, it's a question of leadership.
Are there strategies that you've used to build the capacity of the staff that were already there, that were coming in from the last administration in the public service that works for you?
I think motivation. What we've done is we've had a change of personnel at the senior management of the ministry. But I think it's good to keep people motivated. It's good to keep an open line of engagement. And I think that's what has helped largely is the openness of interaction. But I'm pretty happy with the response. Very happy.
In motivating, are there particular incentives that you use or management techniques?
Example. Again, yeah. I have prosecuted cases in the Magistrate Court. I've prosecuted cases in the Supreme Court on behalf of the state government in the two and a bit years that we've been in office. I think the general belief is that senior lawyers don't go to certain levels of court. I've thrown that out of the window and to demonstrate that as the Attorney General, I am a state counsel, just in the same way as the first year graduate is a state counsel. So I've prosecuted traffic offences, and I have prosecuted constitutional disputes on tax in the Supreme Court. So I've done the bottom rung to the top, and I think that hopefully has demonstrated to the junior staff that if everybody puts in their bit, we're all responsible for the work product of the ministry as a whole. When I started prosecuting traffic offences, people were up in arms that senior lawyers don't do this, well, attorney generals can't do this, why are you using a sledgehammer to kill a fly? And I think after a while, people got they got the message that every infraction of public order is of importance to this government, and we will take it to the highest level.
One of the things I've read is one of the priorities of the administration is to really deal with traffic offenses in particular.
Yeah.
What has been the strategy to deal with that very difficult?
Well, and let me just put this into context and to explain to you that the thesis is this, and you know, we believe it's an unassailable proposition. There is a public order cadre of offences. The offences that people have often overlooked. The offences that, in fact, in their minds, people could even decriminalise, even though in our statute books, they remained offences. And the traffic offences are a perfect example, but then it leads to all sorts of public order, respect for public property, all sorts of nuisances. That sense of chaos, that sense of lack of order is the environment that incubates serious crime. And that in a society where there is no law and order, or that there's the public order is not taken as a priority, you would get a conducive environment for serious and violent crimes. So whereas we continue to pay attention to serious fraud and violent crimes as normal, but we believed that again the first cadre of those offences, you know, the public order offences, we needed to send a strong message that, you know, every citizen deserves an orderly society. It is what we all signed up for in the Constitution, and it's the duty of the state to enforce it. So that has been the strategy, and traffic offences are one of those species of public order offences.
So part of the strategy was the magistrate strategy, which was going to help in this process.
Yes.
What were some of the other parts of that? There must have been a policing component and a prosecution component.
Well, no. The prosecution component of it is the criminal procedure law and the substantive criminal law. Criminal procedure, because that's the book, that's the Bible you use in prosecution. Substantive criminal law, because that's the book that contains all the offenses against the state. We took those two legislations and we revised and reformed and proposed changes. In 2007, the governor signed into law an administration of criminal justice law to show our dedication to criminal justice as a key component of a an orderly society. So the procedure through which criminal trials were to be conducted was contained in this legislation, and it was fully updated, fully revised, with respect for victims, respect for offenders, respect for public property, and respect for the constitutional rights of the presumption of innocence, as well as the right to liberty, in that document. We've only just now finished revising the criminal code law, which was a statute that was over 100 years old. It hadn't been changed in 100 years. And we're the first state government in Nigeria to do it. And we've now sent to the parliament, to the legislature, our proposal for a brand new criminal law of Lagos State, 2009. And a lot of victims' rights, a lot of reforms to do with common assaults, public property, fraud, electronic fraud, all the developments in the last 5 decades all over the world that should have been addressed a long time ago are contained in that document. So we believe the criminal justice system is a very serious component of justice delivery.
And so the thinking was that it was not that people weren't being arrested for these crimes, but the laws and the procedures to make sure that people were being prosecuted and held to account.
That was the problem.
The police were picking them up, but it wasn't.
They weren't being processed properly. Yeah.
Well, I've taken up a lot of your time. If you need to go, that's perfectly fine.
I could do 2 minutes.
Okay. People have said that the need for a former to articulate a vision at the beginning to his staff and to the group is an important part of that. What was your strategy in coming up with, in taking the vision that was there and communicating it to your staff and to getting people on board with that?
No, when we came in, we had a lot of briefings from existing senior staff. I delivered what I felt were the highlights of what our agenda was in the area of administration of justice. I did that at two fora with the staff and with the public. We had a stakeholders summit on administration of justice, at which time we laid out all the reforms that we intended to do. We've gone quite a long distance in rolling out the items on that agenda. We've only just now passed and signed into law a new arbitration law and a statute creating a Lagos Court of International Arbitration, in the belief that we think that private dispute resolution methods can only complement an effective justice system. That if you allow parties the autonomy to resolve their disputes, you can reduce the weight that is on the formal structure of the legal system. So we passed these two laws to reinvigorate the arbitration industry and to also give the investing public confidence that they could take dispute resolutions into their own hands under an institutional framework, and they needn't come to court if the subject matter and the parties agreed with the legislation. So we think that in the overall picture would also be a big slice of effective delivery of solutions to disputes, and therefore reduce the weight on the formal justice system.
Has that arbitration system begun?
The law has been passed. The Court of Arbitration is being set up as we speak. I think the first board of directors will be inaugurated soon. It's a privately driven thing. We are giving an endowment support to it as a state government, and we've played our role by creating the legislative environment and the framework for it to take off. So it is picking up.
When you think about the big picture of what progress has been made in the administration of justice and in the the work on public order, what are some of the things that you're seeing that tell you that success is being found?
Acceptability, acceptance by the public. We have a big test coming up in the new legal year when some of the laws are being operated for the first time. But I think the eagerness with which people are refocusing the way they do things, to me, is a big indication that there's a lot of success. The fact that people are voluntarily taking to the reforms, studying them, and beginning to change their own business models to suit the reforms is a clear indication that the reforms will be successful. But we've got a big test coming later on this year, in the new legal year, when a lot of these rules will be operated for the first time in a formal court environment. So we're eagerly looking forward to it. It's exciting.
Yeah, for sure. When you think about other people coming into a position like this, where they have there's an opening for big reforms in this first couple of years of the experience, what advice would you give them on being a success?
Try and get some sleep. No, but advice. I mean, I think single-mindedness. You need to have a lot of premeditated designs. There's not a lot of time to think on the job. You need to have a thought-out plan because you can get easily distracted. There's a lot while you're trying to do reform-oriented stuff. There's actual day-to-day service that the Attorney General provides, and the office, the Ministry of Justice as a whole, provides. There's a dedicated service that you are supposed to provide for the public in prosecuting the interests of the public under the Constitution. So we can't tell them to shut up, you know. So I mean, you've got to have a lot of single-mindedness and a premeditated vision. I think I gotta go.
Thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.